Nevertheless, the war with the Palestinians was more difficult than laying bombs in the streets or at the markets. This led them to use artillery. The attackers closed in on Deir Yassin. Few defenders were quickly killed. The Zionists, the long history of using explosives like dynamite, blew up the homes of the Palestinians with the inhabitants inside. Then, they announced over loudspeakers that people could leave the village. Escape as soon as possible and save your lives. Those who survived slowly left their homes. The Zionists became even more ruthless, committing a massacre of the people in the most horrific manner possible. The atrocities that occurred are unimaginable. The reports left behind speak of bitter and heartbreaking events. At 10 o'clock in the morning, I visited the Palestinian village of Silwan. No one was willing to speak. They were ashamed. Women, girls, and even elderly women have been subjected to assault and rape. Girls have been mutilated. Infants have been slaughtered. Elderly women have been beaten with rifle butts. In another report from Red Cross representative, it is stated they have thrown the bodies into a pit. A pregnant woman has been shot at close range. The trace of the bullet is still on the woman's clothing. A young Zionist girl shows me a large blood-stained knife. She is a member of the cleanup team. They are killing the wounded. I forcefully entered a house. The house was brimmed with bloodied corpses. I heard a noise. A 10-year-old girl was alive among the bodies. They had cut her wrists so she'd bleed to death. The language is short of telling the rest of the crimes. In the continuation of the crimes in Deir Yassin, they put some Palestinians as prisoners behind the trucks. They take them to the city of Jerusalem and spin them around. Then they return to Deir Yassin and massacre them all. The number of victims is never determined. The reporters, who a few days later, after the crime scene is cleared, enter Deir Yassin with delay. However, the news of the incident quickly spreads throughout all of Palestine. People become frightened, terrified, and flee. This is exactly what the Zionists wanted. The British closely monitored the situation. They looted the remaining belongings of the people and erased the traces of war. Finally, Britain announces it will withdraw its forces from Palestine. The Arabs are taken by surprise. The Zionists, aware of all the details and events, seize the opportunity. They declare the formation of Israel within the land of Palestine in a meeting. America, as the first country, recognizes Israel officially. Wiseman writes, "It was the resistance of the Palestinians that delayed the implementation of the plans." After the departure of Britain, the Haganah seize the leftover weapons and some of them become members of the police to supervise the security and property of the people. This was done in Moshe Dayan's way. He shook hands with the Arabs in the morning and attacked them at night. As tensions boil over, Palestinian villagers are evacuated one after another. Palestine is heading towards destruction. Muslims are getting angry. The flames of war are ignited. Arab armies move towards Palestine in the form of a rescue force. At first, Arabs succeed in advancing. However, the United Nations quickly intervenes and declares a ceasefire. The war comes to a halt. Israel rapidly imports weapons and ammunition, changing the battlefield. The war is lost, and liberated lands are once again occupied. The Arabs are defeated. According to historians and researchers, in 1948, a genocide occurs. There is no exact figure, but at least 13,000 people are killed. The victims are buried in mass graves, and many bodies have been hidden by the Zionists. Out of 1 million Palestinian Muslims, over 750,000 become refugees. Gradually, other Palestinians are also forced to leave their homes and shelters. The poor and the rich all become refugees.
We have to understand what happened in 1948. Imagine half of the population of a country was forcefully expelled. Half of the villages of the country were destroyed. Half of the towns were demolished.
In the midst of all regions, a village has a strange situation. The beautiful village of Tantura by the sea. The people of this village were in a good situation and happy. They too are forced to migrate because a bitter incident has occurred. The Zionists besiege the village of Tantura. They separate the men from the women. They abduct a girl from the population. The girl's uncle complains. They immediately kill him. In the same vicinity, the girl is brutally raped. Then they drag the men to the barbed wire fence and systematically kill them. In this village, genocide also takes place. In other areas, the situation is the same. Murder and looting are rampant. The fate of the people is uncertain. Those who remain endure immense hardship, sorrow, and grief. Forced migration begins throughout all of Palestine. The traces of tears remain. A civilization is on the brink of destruction. The land is being usurped from its rightful owners. Thus, the 14th of May, 1948, is named the Day of Catastrophe, or Nakba. After the people's migration, those who have nowhere to go remain in occupied areas and experience life under Zionist rule. These individuals are known as the 1948 Arabs. They witnessed the massacres of 1948. Gradually, immigrants enter. They seize the properties of Muslims and take whatever is left as their own. They plunder and take over everything. In the 1950s, the Egyptian government decides not to renew the treaty with Britain for the control of the Suez Canal. This is a prelude to confronting Israel. Britain cannot tolerate this and attacks Egyptian forces. In 1956, the Egyptian government nationalizes the Suez Canal. This is a rational move, and Egypt's taken its decision. 3 months later, Britain, France, and Israel prepare for war. The war begins with Israel's attack. With the resistance of the Egyptians and international actions, the war quickly comes to an end. The War of 1956 does not bring any achievement for Israel. The fire smolders under the ashes in 1967. Israel suddenly attacks Egypt. The Egyptian army is caught off guard. What the Egyptian forces are doing, though, accompanied by great courage, does not lead to anything. Egyptian soldiers are besieged in the Sinai Desert. Israel seeks revenge. They massacre the Egyptian soldiers. After Egypt, the remaining Arab countries also suffer defeat. As a result, Israel occupies more land. The main factor in the Arabs' defeat was the support of the United States, advanced telecommunications equipment, and espionage activities. More importantly, it was the fate of Palestine, which was on the line. After the war, the area of Israel triples. Many become refugees, and the remaining people are trapped under Israeli rule. Grief and sorrow have engulfed the Arabs. In 1967, the United Nations adopted a resolution in the hope that Israel would withdraw from the occupied lands. However, Israel conditions its withdrawal from the occupied territories on the recognition of its legitimacy. This is vital to them. In response, Arabs emphasized three things: no peace, no negotiations, and no recognition of Israel. 3 years after the Six-Day War, Israel does not relinquish any of the occupied lands. They make excuses. For example, they do not return the Sinai Desert to Egypt under the pretext of Israeli security. Therefore, in 1973, Egypt and Syria launch attacks to forcibly reclaim their lands in the Sinai and the Golan Heights. The war initially sees some victories, but with direct intervention from the United States, the war's fate changes. The war ends with the defeat of the Arabs. In 1977, Anwar Sadat, president of Egypt, travels to Israel in a state of disbelief. Conversations begin. 1 year later, negotiations lead to results. Egypt surrenders. The Camp David Accords are signed. In Camp David, it is agreed that in exchange for peace, Israel will withdraw from Gaza and the West Bank of the Jordan River, paving the way for self-governance or Palestinian authority in these regions. In essence, Camp David was a document to officially recognize Israel so that it would not be isolated. Egypt was the biggest threat to Israel from the start, and Israel tried in every way to find peace from Egypt's side.
So we should be such neighbors that they would feel that it's nice to live with us.
So it was necessary for Egypt, as the first Arab country, to recognize Israel in order to eliminate the biggest threat to Israel forever. In the 1970s, everything was in favor of Israel. Continuous victories, success after success. There was no news about the Israeli society. What was seen were the victories of the army. Meanwhile, within the society, strange events were taking place that conflicted with human values. After the war, thousands of people, Jews, migrated to the occupied lands, including Yemenis. They were settled in temporary camps. Different individuals, men and women, old and young, appeared in those camps. Women arrived with their children and infants. Immediately, medical examinations began. Doctors, under the pretext of more detailed examinations, took some children with them. It was said they would return the next day, but the next day, there was no news of the children. Those children never returned. Families followed through the matter, but a strange event occurs. It is said that your children are missing. They are gone. Sometime later, Another news is announced to them, your children are dead. The cause of death is never revealed. Yemeni children were lively and cheerful before being sent to the hospital, but on the way to the hospital, they bid farewell to their childhood forever. The peak of the missing children statistics is reached in 1953. It is said that nearly 5,000 people have disappeared. Shortly after, a fact-finding committee is formed. The investigations yield no specific results. The fate of the children remains unknown. Even worse than that is the function of the committees, as in each review of documents, a series of records go missing and no trace is left behind. The documents, like the children themselves, vanish into thin air. As time goes by, secrets are revealed about what had happened to the kids. The children were subjected to a host of nondescript medical tests. The clinical tests were made in the city of Haifa. Physicians had tried different methods of treatment on the children's bodies, including direct injection of dry protein. The kids were used as laboratory mice. In one case, four Yemeni children suffering from malnutrition were injected with dry protein. This causes the death of children. Dr. George Mendel, head of the Children's Hospital, was aware of the tests. There were even worse cases among the files of Yemeni children. Unethical and inhumane things. Organ theft. The body parts of Yemeni children had been stolen and a bitter fate had been set for them. However, it is not known exactly how many children were killed in such a manner. The story of Yemeni children grieves many families, but the crime against children was not just for Yemeni immigrants. Immigrant families, even from the Balkan region, were involved with this issue. The depth of the disaster was much greater than what was revealed in the media. In essence, in the Israeli society, those who had a weaker position were harassed more than others. Traces of discrimination and racism were clearly seen in the case of Yemeni children. The authorities tried to make the situation seem normal, but the events that happened indicated many gaps and ruptures in Israeli society, which they tried to ignore and keep hidden forever.
No pardon?
And the Arabs are inferior?
I wouldn't like to say that, but I think as fighting girls, they are.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Jannah,
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 53rd letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha, which is the letter that he wrote to Malik Ashtar when he appointed him as the governor of Egypt, of Misr of that time. And in this letter, there are many important guidances for those who have managerial positions, especially in the government, especially when it comes to being in the government of a country or a state. And he offers very wonderful advice to Malik Ashtar. Amongst them are to do with the human resources and how to deal with people, how to recruit them and how to deal with them. And we say that in one of the phrases, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَةً وَأَثَرَةً. That do not keep these people in position. Do not keep people in position who are, who you keep them out of kindness or, let's say, out of your own opinion or, you know, out of some other reasons that are not based on firm criteria. Do not do that, because afterwards it can be harmful.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to say about the reasoning behind this. That means when Imam Ali alayhi salam says that test and examine people who you want to give position, number one. Number two, those who want to work in the government, whether it be they have leadership position or they have other positions in the government system. Then when you employ them, do not employ them whimsically, following your own opinions out of just a fake kindness or just, you know, being kind and things like that. Don't do that. Why? He says, فَإِنَّهُمْ جِمَاعٌ مِنْ شُعَبِ الْجَوْرِ وَالْخِيَانَةِ. He says it's because these people that are working for the government, they are the central, these are a gathering of groups of oppression and betrayal. Oh no. Such harsh statements. That means all these government workers are a groups, are gatherings of groups of oppression and betrayal and treason. What does that mean? Is Imam Ali alayhi salam accusing everyone who is working in the government, everyone, to be people of oppression and betrayal and treason? No. That's not what Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying. Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to say here, what Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to say here is that there is very much potential of oppression and treason and betrayal in these people. Why? It's because they have got the keys to very important issues. They have the keys to the treasury. They have the keys to information, sensitive information. They have the keys of authority. They have the keys to the resources that exist, the natural resources and the artificial resources. They are in control of many things. And because of this authority and this control and this and the wealth that they have access to for serving the people, it makes them in a position where they can very easily misuse this position and commit oppression or betrayal or treason. See, this is the reason why Imam Ali alayhi salam says that. And therefore, when you know that this is a very sensitive area, it's only intellectual to choose and to be careful that you don't just bring people into authority or into the system without prior examination and without constantly vetting them and not basing your decisions on just your own feelings and desires.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us that, look, why do we need to be serious here when it comes to government, when it comes to institutes that have impact on the society? In a way, it's because you as a government have a covenant to serve the community. You have a duty to be able to do what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. You are responsible with regards to the aims and objectives of that institute, of that governing body, of that government. The destiny of millions of people are in your control, depending on which level of authority you have. Now, if that is the level of sensitivity, wouldn't it be the best thing to follow very strict criteria when calling people into authority? Unfortunately, there's another problem that happens nowadays, and that is that people bring people into authority or give them positions or bring them in the system because of wealth. Just because they have wealth, let's say, or they are influential and they have money. That should not be the main reason. Yes, sometimes to have these people it's good because then they can help out. But if they are adhering to the aims and objectives of that government or that institute, not that they have another direction, and in fact when they come inside your system, they kind of buy you off, you know. The opposite happens. Instead of them being used to do the right thing, they use you to do what is wrong. You know, all this is very important. Inshallah, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives the tawfiq to everyone who is in any leadership position or managerial seat to be able to take heed of these pieces of advice of Imam Ali alayhi salam and apply them in their lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of the one who is so kind and caring and who would never ever neglect us and leave us to ourselves. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Warm salam and peace to all of you. I don't know where you are, what you're doing, what time it is in your country right now, but wherever you are, welcome to our program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. We are talking about different roots of laziness in our teenagers. We are here with our beloved dear sister Khalfan in the studio, who is an Islamic researcher. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for accepting our invitation. So previously, I mean, we were talking about motivation and like saying like really good positive affirmation to our children, and we shifted to how fathers have also be responsible. What do you have for us today?
Yeah, I just want to talk more about how to, you know, like go about this scheme of motivating the children, which is very important that we communicate emphatically with our teens. Emphatically, empathy is something that you understand what he has to say. Okay, talk to your teen and listen to what he has to say, even if it's not exactly what you want to hear. Sometimes you don't want to hear the things that they have to say. It's so much like childish for us, or sometimes it's so much lack of experience, you know, that he has. But we should listen emphatically, getting each and every word and showing it to him and really meaning that. That we are listening to him and we are feeling what he's feeling.
Sister Khalfan, your 5, 6, 7-year-old, they would come talk to you.
Yeah.
Teenagers would like avoid talking to you. You would have to go to them.
No. I believe that's
please,
the Western world.
Please tell me what's going on.
That's the Western world. If you go and see
no,
our
even
Islamic
the,
world,
even in the Islamic
if you
world,
have raised your children nicely, they would still say some words to you.
What if in the Islamic world there are kids who don't like to talk to you?
Then you can start with, I understand, there must be something bothering you because you're very upset. You look very upset, and because of that, even I feel upset. Please, let's share it. Maybe I can, you know, like we can share it together.
Like,
not
okay,
that
Mom.
You have to advise them.
Okay.
Or you have to nag them. You have to, you know, cut them short and tell them, no, this is wrong. Just listen to them, what they have to say. Even if something that, you know, normally we want to be happy with them. It's our feelings that we see, that I am so sad and distressed about. What about their feelings? Share it with them. That, you know, for example, just when a child is, for example, very sad and depressed, and you just try to talk to them, that I know how you feel. It must be so, like, you know, a feeling that is, you know, you want to end this day, or you're feeling so lonely. I've even faced this loneliness. You're not alone in that. Not that, no, come, I show you the ways of how I'm feeling happy. No, that's like not posing solutions to the problem. Empathy. Sharing it with him. I know how you feel. It must be very bad for you, yeah, to undergo this feeling. Or it must be so hard for you to, for example, lose a friend. Or it must be very upsetting for you to have got these marks after studying so hard. Right? I understand. But it's the effort. Remember, it's the effort. But I know how upset you are. I know what you must be going through. And I know you need time to think about it. You know, give them that space. Give them that feeling that you know, and believe it or not, this is such a positive thing that it changes clock, like for example, completely 180 degrees. The child will actually feel that now that he's understood, he's become happy.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced that a lot of times, that I know you're upset because of certain thing. I've talked to my child and I know how sad you must be. But what to do? We have to give up this idea. Yeah? We have to fight against this kind of, for example, thought. We have to stand up and say that it's not the end of the world. Yeah, there's so many other things that we can do. But I know how sad you feel. It's normal. Even I might have gone through this situation. And it's very, very hard. But time will pass. You'll see. Everything will be normal. And give them space. Don't advise them now. Stop feeling sad, or this is what you should do. Or, you know, if you be sad, then your shaitan is coming to you in this kind of talks. They don't want to hear these kind of things at that time. They just want empathy and to be understood, mm-hmm. that somebody is with us. They understand. Even if they've fallen down, you know, for small children, you have to say that it hurts so much. Not that, let it stop hurting. It hurts so much, I know. Let's have a lie down. Maybe it'll be better. Let me give you this medicine. Maybe it'll be better. So this is how you go along, that when you communicate emphatically with your teen, the teen will feel wanted. They'll feel that they have a friend to communicate with. And then they will feel, of course, that motivation that they're doing it for who? They're doing it to make the parents happy also, whatever they're doing. So as studying is concerned, you know, anything that they, it's important for them.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear Muslim brothers and sisters. We are talking about providing empathy to our loved ones, to our teenage daughters or sons, and how it's so vital, how it's so important to make them understand that we feel for them, that we're there for them whenever they need us.
That's right. So one of the things to communicate and make this effective communication to build motivation is to be careful, as I pointed out to in our last episode, meal times.
Mm-hmm.
Choose the meal times and make such kind of diet for the child that they like having that. Doesn't have to be unhealthy food, but something that they enjoy to have. And you know, at that time when the energy is got, you know, when you get energy from food, you become a bit more activated and you feel happier when you get your needs being met. Everyone, you know, when they have their needs being met, they become better, happier. You can see a child who's so cranky when they get their feed and their meals, then they are now smiling and they're playing, you see?
Even their parents are.
Yeah, so it happens to all. So the teenagers also, if you want, the meal times are the best.
To talk.
To talk to, yeah. So if they don't want to talk and they want their own, for example, they want to be in their own world, don't talk to them at that time. Maybe you can just lend an ear to them, or maybe just tell them, you know, be sympathetic to them and empathetic to them. And then after that, when you know, you call them for a meal and they sit down, then you can open up the conversation slowly by slowly, and you'll see at that time the conversation will get more and more better as the time passes in the table.
So we're talking about motivating our children. Was this the topic?
Yes, motivating the children, because when you listen to them and talk to them, that's when they know that you are friendly with them, you understand them. So they will feel motivated. They will feel that there's somebody who cares for us. They'll feel, you know, that I'm not just doing these things just like that for nobody.
I matter to my
parents. Yeah, I matter to my parents. And I have to prove mm-hmm. certain things to my parents
mm-hmm.
because they respect me. They understand me. They give me my space. They give me my independence. They don't underestimate me.
Yeah, I totally understand. Okay, let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said
يا
honor your children, and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. We're talking about motivational strategies that we as parents, moms or dads, can use with our loved ones, with our teenagers. And previously we talked about how important mealtimes are. This is the time where we're giving a lot of nourishment, emotional support and care and love to our families and loved ones. And then in this part of our program, we're going to talk about some other motivational strategies.
Yeah.
Such as?
For example, pay attention to your teen's interests. Sometimes, you know, the interests are so, you know, like apart, the mother and the boy, for example, mm-hmm. if you go and see. The child loves football and the mother doesn't know ABC about the football. So how can they pay attention to their interest? This is a big question, right? So the mother can also pretend. Yes, she can pretend to, or even more so, come to know about this, for example, football. Ask the child, how, for example, do you go about to make a goal? Tell me. I mean, I'm amazed that there's so many footballers out there, yet everyone is important and everyone has a role to play. How do you make a goal? Mm-hmm. And that teenager will talk and talk about his interests. So you're also paying attention to his interests. If he likes books, for example, which book have you latest read? Tell me about it. What interested you in that? Even you, and then give remarks on that, you know, like, I like this, for example, or I find this very difficult, or maybe do you have more books on that? Mm-hmm. Or maybe I can find out more about that area of interest so that you can communicate and motivate in the process. But it's very easy to know. For example, I know of a teenage boy whose mother encouraged him so much to keep on his cooking ability. That he won a big prize and he had other potentials as well. So she never underestimated the fact that she's
cooking. I like
cooking.
That mother.
Yeah, the mother, you know, she's so much like, she's got only one son. Imagine that one son must be like a big dream for her to be a pilot or a technician, whatever it is. But a cook.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's like, another mother would say, oh my God, he's interested in cooking from a young age. He likes making cakes and ice creams and I don't know what not. And the mother encouraged him so much that he won so many competitions.
Wow.
And at the same time, the mother had so much faith in him that he would not lag behind his secular education as well. And now the child is pursuing in becoming a physician, a doctor.
Wow.
So it doesn't mean that, you know, if one ability gets enhanced, the other one dies down. No, there may be so many good abilities. The child finds it along the way himself. See, he knew that this cook and chef business, more of a lady kind of, you know, like a job, you see. So we can't underestimate this kind of occupation. But still, if a mother was like a, came to know about even her daughter taking more interest in these kind of things, she would feel that I want my daughter to become more pursued in other kind of activities, right? Other professions, like for example, a professor or a teacher, or, you know, specializing in certain other, like computers or whatever. But I say that always respect you. Even I know of a boy who's so interested in stitching clothes. That's more of a female-oriented occupation.
Taylor.
But the father has encouraged him so much that, yeah, if you want to stitch clothes, yeah.
Go ahead, stitch
trying
clothes.
It out. Yeah, he looks at the computer and sometimes he finds out how to go about, you know, cutting the model of the cloth.
Wow.
And he goes about, you know, stitching it however much. And the father encourages him. Who says the tailors are underestimated or low people? Or they're not respected.
Exactly.
Nothing like that. You never know, he becomes tailor of a great business and he makes a factory of all this kind of clothes.
So
that,
true.
That then go to big, big shops.
Exactly.
Tailor good material because of that encouragement. So never underestimate your child's interests.
That's
always, so always. You don't have to over even do it, for example, okay. But buy the things that are necessary if he asks for them. For example, if he wants to, like this person whom I mentioned, she has a son who loved cooking. He wanted ingredients. Okay, buy for him the ingredients. I want to make this today. Buy for him the ingredients. Today I feel like trying this recipe. Get the ingredients for him. or I want to stitch this cloth, a trousers or a shirt or a blouse, get for me the material. Buy for him the material to encourage him, to experience, to explore. Do I really like it? There are many a time that people go and join a certain kind of occupation. They're halfway, they feel that they can't continue. It's not their piece of job.
Exactly.
It's not their piece of interest. And then they choose another path.
Exactly.
When they're complete adults, of course, in university. Because when we talk about how laziness is formed, it's when he starts something and stops it and halfway. That we should not allow in our children. We should try to make them complete so that they know how to feel that sense of achievement, that they did something, that accomplishment, right?
Exactly. So, thank you so much. This was very beautiful points that you mentioned, that you shared with us. And we have reached the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. On this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at concerns around police corruption and media freedom. Our special guest is an award-winning journalist who's been at the centre of recent controversy regarding clandestine efforts by both the police and security services in attempts to access his confidential sources. But before we do, let's get a rundown on what seems to be a recurring theme within policing institutions.
In 2014, Theresa May, the then British Home Secretary, commissioned a public inquiry into allegations that undercover police officers had spied on the family of Stephen Lawrence during their campaign to compel police to investigate the racist murder of their son. May called the revelations profoundly shocking and disturbing. Retired Judge Sir John Meading was appointed to examine the conduct of officers who'd spied on more than 1,000 political groups between 1968 and at least 2010. In June, Meading's first report was published, arising out of the inquiry's work and what has now become known as the Spy Cop scandal. It also followed revelations that undercover officers were regularly involved in long-term sexual relationships with women during this time. At least four of the undercover officers are known or alleged to have fathered children with women they met during their work. In July this year, more revelations have been uncovered, this time with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, into allegations that they had obtained the authorisation to access telephone records of journalist Barry McCaffrey, after he approached the PSNI's press office in 2013 with questions for a story he was working on about alleged corruption in the police force. McCaffrey was later arrested along with fellow journalist Trevor Burney after a documentary they were both involved in exploring the role of police collusion into the deaths of six civilians in Loughan Island in 1994 uncovered a cover-up into the killings. These latest allegations once again shine a spotlight into a police force that has been at the centre of a number of controversies since it was reformed and renamed following the Patton Inquiry's recommendations in 2001.
As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest is award-winning journalist Barry McCaffrey. Many of you might remember Barry from the film No Stone Unturned, an explosive exposé that shone the spotlight on British state collusion in the massacre of six civilians who were watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy at the World Cup in June 1994. Instead of Barry's investigative work imploring the police to examine the findings and prosecute the suspects, he and fellow journalist Trevor Burney became the focus of police attention. This led to both men being arrested in August 2018, only to be later vindicated and awarded damages. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
Firstly, Barry, how did you become a journalist?
Just by chance, Sean. I had work experience at school. I was lucky enough to end up in the Irish News. You know, it was 1985. Computers hadn't come in then. It was still typewriters and Tippex and things like that. Then, you know, it's during summer holidays, I volunteered for the Irish Times. It used to be in Phantom House in Belfast, and ended up working on building sites in Jersey in the late 80s and early 90s, and eventually came home, was doing a night class just for the headspace to do something, and somebody ended up saying that they were going to do a journalist course, and I just followed them. So it was just always by chance, you know.
Barry, we're going to talk a wee bit about your work on the film No Stone Unturned, but before we do that, we're going to have a wee look at the trailer for the film.
The World Cup Finals. I'd say the biggest day in Irish international soccer history.
Slaughter in Lochan Island as loyalist terrorists shoot 11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television.
I just remember Mum was saying to us that bad men had come into the pub and they'd shot 6 people and Daddy was dead.
Did you see anything?
No.
The getaway car was discovered the morning after the attack.
There was just a sense that something wasn't right.
Somebody somewhere helped these people cover this up.
We were thwarted all the time. Every question we asked, we were told, we can't tell you that, that's national security.
They were absolutely ruthless.
I'll never forget their words, we will leave no stone unturned, and those words ring in my ear to this day, because I don't think they've ever left a stone, never mind turned it.
So I was briefed to go down to Belfast and interview several people. What was unusual is that I was told who I could speak to, who I couldn't speak to, what they would be saying, but just as importantly, what they wouldn't be saying.
Certainly the bigger picture was there was this gang in operation, and they were involved in serious criminality.
Obviously there was things going on above my head.
The paper trail will lead to the British government, and they cannot allow that to happen.
The police were saying the car was destroyed. I thought, hold on, the largest physical exhibit in the case, and you've destroyed it?
10 years with no information, we were kept in the dark.
They knew all along about the dirty war.
You're taking me into an area that I don't really want to go to.
I can't take the risk.
If I can hit somebody early enough and there's a weak one amongst this team, they might start tumbling.
How come they didn't do it?
Good question.
I really do believe it goes as far up to the right to the top.
It still gets me every time, Barry, every time I see a trailer or a piece of the film or the film itself, you know, just what the families went through, the victims went through, and, you know, the events that evening were horrendous, but the events leading from that and the way the police didn't investigate still leaves you with more questions than answers, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Especially for the families, you know, nearly 30 years later, they still... the only answers they've got is they found them out themselves, you know, and they've had to drag the RUC and the PSNI, you know, kicking and screaming in the courts to try and get any truth whatsoever. And, you know, that quest, that challenge still goes on. You know, the PSNI seem to be more interested in protecting, you know, the man who they say was the killer, rather than giving the families justice.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us just a bit more about the film. How did you become involved in the film itself? What happened?
Well, it went back to... So for the first 10 years, from 94 to 2005. The families kept a dignified silence. They didn't do any media. They didn't speak at all because the police had told them, leave it with us. You know, we will leave no stone unturned. You know, and they put their trust in the police, which you would do in, you know, if you lived in Dublin or London or Glasgow. You trust, it's supposed to be a police service, somebody who serves the public, protects the public. So, like every decent person, the families believed that, you know, the police were their best option. And then in 2005, they realised that they'd been told lies for 10 years. And through Niall Murphy, their solicitor, they agreed to speak for the first time. And they did that through myself with the Irish News. And Niall and the families had tried to do documentaries with the BBC, but the BBC had told them that they weren't interested in legacy cases anymore. And it was just a chance meeting between Trevor and Niall and myself. And Trevor said, well, why don't we do something? That because we were naming the killers or the people who the PSNI said carried out the murders, we were concerned that we would be injuncted and, you know, their identities or the role that they played would never be exposed.
So incredibly, Barry, after all that had been exposed and what had been seen within the film and the expectations that would have been there, you were arrested along with Trevor Burney.
Yes, yeah. Trevor and myself were arrested on the 31st of August 2018. To go back, when the film premiered, we expected a reaction from the PSNI. Probably naively, we expected the PSNI to say, right, we look at the allegations in this film and, you know, we'll reopen the investigation, and if we find that they are true, you know, we'll go after the killers. And if it's not, the filmmakers will be discredited. But instead, what they did was they did say that they would reopen the investigation, but it was to find out who our sources were, and that was, you know, that was a scary moment, or you started to realise this is a bit strange. You're not going after the killers anymore. You're shooting the messenger, and that was so. That led on for a year, and we had our concerns about what would happen, but we never thought that we would be arrested. The normal tried and tested method that the relationship between the police and any police force and journalists or filmmakers, if the police believe you have information that they believe, you know, it could help solve a crime or whatever, they go to court and they look for a production order from a judge, and they go into court and the journalists or the filmmakers go into court and you argue the issue out in front of a judge and a judge decides, and that's the way it should have been. That's the way anywhere else in the world that it happens, but that's not the way it happens here. So on the 31st of August 2018, 7 a.m. So I look down the stairs and I see this blue boiler suit, this figure in a blue boiler suit, you know, at the front door. And it's at that stage you think, right, that's either one or two people. That's either the UVF or the killer coming to shoot us, or it's the police. And you have a decision to make at that stage, you know. Do you run back in and hide underneath the bed, you know? Or, you know, do you let them put the door in? Or what do you do? So I decided, you know, I'd just go down the stairs and sort of front it out, whatever it was, you know. And I was sort of delighted when it was a cop at the door, you know. It felt like hugging him. We arrive at Musgrave Street Police Station, and there's two levels to Musgrave Street. There's the the ground level was for the shoplifters, and, you know, somebody got drunk and made a fool of themselves or whatever. And then the second level, the penthouse, that's the anti-terror suite, that's the Bin Laden suite. And I was hoping we were going down into the shoplifters, but no, we ended up going up in the lift. And then you're stripped, and you've DNA taken, your fingerprints, and